What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we are coming to you live from a couple of places on the internet. We're live on Facebook. We're live on YouTube. We're live on Twitch. We're live on X. Yeah, we are on X right now, you guys. It is wild. Maybe you're listening to the podcast later. Spotify, Apple, Google. Maybe you're listening on Google.com. That's a place you can listen to podcasts.
You just type in Pete LePage and the podcast starts playing.
Wherever it is you are listening, wherever it is you are watching, we appreciate you checking it out. We have a great show for you tonight. We are in we're in different states. We're in three different states currently.
Shocking.
I'm in New York. Pete, you're in Maryland, right?
Maryland, yes.
Maryland. That's where
and Justin, you're down in
Louisiana. Louisiana. NOLA, the Big Easy, down here for work. You know, we often talk about what great cocktail we're drinking. I'm drinking good old American hot coffee because I have an all-night shoot ahead of me tonight. Ooh. Uh-oh.
That's awesome. Am I allowed to bring up the fact you just mentioned? It has nothing to do with comic books, but it blew
sure,
my mind.
Yeah.
So you're doing the shoot in a supermarket, of course, overnight because the supermarket stuff happens during the day. And so I jokingly asked you, "Oh, can you grab whatever you want off the shelves and eat it?" And you said,
"That we can, if we want to get a snack, we can take a picture of it, send it to our production manager, and they will buy it afterwards." I'll tell you, it is weird to be in a grocery store at night because it's you just walk around if you want. There's like all the stuff's there.
Find yourself in the candy aisle a lot, or are you just gonna?
No. The reason I don't, Pete, is simple. I'm not Pete LePage. I'm a little bit different, so I'm not just slathering,
I would just kind of find reasons to shoot over in that area and just be like, "Oh, guys,
you know. Can we shoot in the candy?"
Yeah. Could you imagine if Pete was on that shoot? You'd walk over to the candy and be like, "Hey, where's Pete?" Walk over to the candy aisle. He'd be like Garfield.
Yeah, I'd be like, "I ran out of room on my phone sending pictures to the production manager."
Just turn around and say, "Help me, Justin, help me. I ate everything."
All right, why don't we bring in our first set of guests for the evening? They are the creators of the new book from IDW, Killmore, which is wild and violent and awesome. I'm very excited to chat with them about this. Returning guests, Scott Brian Wilson, and a new guest, Max Allen Fuchs. Hello, welcome, guys.
What's up?
Hey. So excited to have you here. Before we get into the book, though, I wanted to tease something up here. Now, Justin, we didn't say this at the beginning, but is down in New Orleans where Stray Bullet, Brett Macris, a real legit chef, lives and work, and you've been hanging out with him.
Famous
a bunch.
Down here.
And every week he either curates or creates a cocktail for the show. And this week he created one for you guys. This is a cocktail called the Mary Fuchs Killmore. And it's Saint Germain gin, which is the Mary, gin, which is the Fuchs. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
You are.
Okay, excellent. The Mezcal, which is the Killmore, cranberry juice, lime, and simple syrup. It sounds delicious. I didn't have most of these ingredients around at the current time, but I'm very excited to make this one. So there you go. A cocktail.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
Thank you. I can't wait to try this shit later.
And Scott, I think you're the Mary in this scenario, isn't it?
Of course I am.
Yeah.
Congrats. It's hard to hold on to.
No other fucking option. Come on.
All right. Well, let's chat about this book. We got an advance chance to read this. This is coming out on September 13th, I believe. Is that correct from IDW?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. There are so many wild things going on in this book. I hesitate to start describing the concept because I don't know what you do and do want to hint at or spoil. But Scott, do you want to talk about the concept a little bit?
Yeah, it's about a collapsing city that becomes overrun by serial killers. And the two cops who are still around the precinct who are trying to take him down.
There you go. Well, that pretty much covers it. That's all the stuff I was worried about spoiling. So we can jump right into it.
Well, it doesn't touch on the sheer number of kills, murders, and gristle that we see in this first issue. what's up, guys? Everything cool?
Well, Max, I mean, on that note, there are a lot of different kills in here and a lot of different ways. When you're drawing things like that, I'm sure at least a little bit comes from the script, but how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it different? And how do you deal with drawing all of that gruesome stuff?
I really don't know how other people aren't thinking about those things all the time. and there's, you know, it's not going to let up either. We're moving into working on the fifth issue now. And, you know, those are the scenes that I'm living for every issue. You know, it's like, I can't wait to get to another opportunity to flex on some creative grisly murder scene.
Wow. Well, and Scott, are you guys like, yeah, do you have like a list of like, well, what if here are like 100 ways for people to die, and you're just sort of picking and choosing as you go, or how are you working through this?
I mean, it's all driven by the story, right? You know, Scott's writing a very tight narrative here, and I'll usually just add the little sprinkle of something extra gnarly on top of it.
Yeah, there's a kill in issue 4 that is going to gross you the fuck out, and it's going to blow people's minds. When it was in the script, it was very sort of mild, because at that point I knew what Max was going to do, and I was like, yeah, just fucking go for it. And it shocked me when I saw it. So, and then I think there's one in issue 7 that I can't wait. I know it's coming. It's going to be so much grosser and better than I thought. But yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of killers in the book, and you only get to see some of them in the first issue. But yeah, when I was plotting it out, I made an Excel sheet of all the killers, and because I realized I couldn't fucking keep track of everything. So just trying to each issue, who appears, how many pages, what are they doing? Just so that I could get the pacing right and the rhythm right. You don't want to go too long without seeing someone unless there's a story reason for it, or, you know, you don't want to make it look kind of haphazard. You want it to feel really, you know, correctly paced. So that drove part of it too, is like the individual stories of the killers when they show up. And there's a lot of surprising things that are going to happen in the book for sure.
Well, Could you talk a little bit about the thematic nature of the book? Because I don't know if I'm reading this wrong, but it felt a little bit, I don't know if it started here, but it felt a little bit like you're playing with the idea of when a factory city gets abandoned and then taking that to the absolute biggest possible extreme. Is that kind of on the right track of where you started with, or am I off?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it kind of evolved from my, you know, original idea. You know, I just had the idea of a bunch of killers, right? But then you start thinking, like, where would they function best? Well, it wouldn't be in a regular city because you'd be caught too fast. Too difficult, right? Too many police, too many people. But if it was a city that, say, the upper and middle classes had fled because the industry left, right, then you have fewer people. Then I started thinking, like, well, if there aren't that many people, a lot of cops are going to quit, firemen are going to quit, you know, whatever, firefighters, fucking teachers, everybody's going to fucking quit, right? Like, they're going to go somewhere where that's not dangerous. And, you know, so then I just realized, like, it would be like a playground, essentially. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, that's the, you know, the blood and the kills are the fun part. But yeah, there's a lot of, like, sort of social commentary and things happening as well, right? It's not just blood and guts. But yeah, there's a lot below the surface if you want to sort of look into things and think about, you know, some of the things you're talking about.
Yeah, what I was thinking when I was reading it was that the killers almost feel like an inevitability, a natural disaster, like climate change, where, like, there's no way of stopping them. And our cops, who are sort of like the vulnerable townspeople as a giant tsunami of blood is coming toward them.
Yeah,
like,
I think
I feel like I haven't seen a story that puts the sort of heroes in such a vulnerable, like, lack of knowledge spot.
Yeah, right. So I think Max was the one who said at one point, he's like, this is a book about compulsion, right? Not only the compulsion of the killers, because, as you know, like, you know, serial killers, it's like this compulsion, right? But also the compulsion of the cops who were staying behind against every good sense, staying behind and working these cases, right? And you know, and I'm always much more interested in the villains and the bad guys, you know, and than the heroes. So for me, it was just interesting to try to write a book sort of based around, even though the heroes have probably more screen time in the end than the villains, they're such overwhelming presence. You're always aware of them, right? And for me, that was sort of the fun, the sort of fun approach is really starting with the villains and going from there.
Max, go ahead, Pete. Sorry, you got interrupted before.
I just wanted to say that these covers are absolutely amazing. The art is just super tight bananas. It's really impressive what's happening in this book.
That's a compliment if you're not familiar with how Pete.
Thanks.
Also,
we got,
like,
a lot of great people on those variant covers. We were really lucky to work with these folks.
It was really fun to kind of get a chance to see them all and stuff. This is an absolute nightmare book, though. I mean, some of the stuff just in the first issue has haunted me in ways that I'll never be able to forget. Are you worried at all about going too far? Because, like, this is just such a, like, if a city gets abandoned and then, like, you know, nobody's around, like, the creepiest people in the world all come together in a way that is just something we've never seen before. That is just absolute.
Peter, are you worried this is going to happen, like, near where you live?
I think that, you know, there is, see a version of this happening to a city in a horrible way. So
so we're going down for Baltimore Comic Con. This is a little bit of a side trip. And I told Pete, oh, I got an Airbnb. Like,
I mean, this
walk away.
I just have a question about
the convention center.
I just have a question.
No, but this
about
is what we're getting at, right? And you were like, no, you're going to die. You are going to die.
I'm just saying
if
that
far from the convention center. No, they're going to kill you. Your first question was, have you seen The Wire?
Well, I'll tell you, I went to college in Baltimore at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and I spent a lot of time as a poor college student just walking around Baltimore. And this was a long time ago, but one of the magical things about Baltimore is that you can be, like, in a really swank neighborhood one second with, like, beautiful brownstones, $2 million houses, and you can cross a street and be, you know, right next to a flaming trash can and needles all over the street. It's just like block to block, or at least it was.
He's trying to save you, Alex.
All right. No, I apologize.
All that aside, do you guys worry about going too far with this in a way that's, like, too scary, or are you like, let's keep haunting people's dreams and thoughts?
Put it this way, it's not Crossed, right? Which is a book I really admire, and I've read every issue of Crossed. I think it's a fantastic book. It's not Crossed in terms of just being there for sheer grossness or sheer the shock value, right? I think a lot of the horror is in, like you say, it's in the between the lines, the psychological part of it, you know? And even in some of the, even throughout the book, a lot of the kills are left to the imagination, right? Versus just always seeing everything right on the page, which I think that is pretty powerful too, when you think, because you know what's happening, right? You know what's happening. You can hear it, or it's implied, or somebody goes in a room and you know what's going to happen, you know? So I think that can be scarier than just sheer shock value on the page. There's a place for that, but we're definitely not Crossed for sure.
Max, can you talk about the design of the killers a little bit? Again, I'm sure at least part of this came from the collaboration and the script and everything, but they're so interesting because they're not what you would expect from, like, slasher horror movie villains. They all have very different types. Anybody who's watching the live show, you got to see the old lady. People were joking in the comments that we finally find out Sophia's time in Sicily, what went on in this book here with that character. But you've also got this great character introduced called the giraffe, who I don't want to get into too many of the jokes, but the jokes were killer there. And then you have this other character that we saw here on the live show, just this really jacked lady with blonde hair who's running around the city pummeling people to death. So that was a lot of prelude for anybody who's listening who doesn't know what the stuff looked like. But Max, could you talk about the design of the characters a little bit and how you embrace them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Scott's been living with these characters in his head for you know, the better part of a decade, maybe.
Hope you're okay, Scott.
And, you know, for all of them, he had a high concept. And for some, you know, we have from his creation of them, some guidelines for how they would look. And like I said about the developing the kill scenes in the script, you know, I'm just coming along and sprinkling a little spice, adding my own ideas to it. Like you mentioned, Lady Face Smasher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the I think the description that Scott put in the original pitch packet that I was kind of working from initially was that it was like an Archie girl face on a bodybuilder's body.
Betty from Betty and Veronica. Yeah.
So I sort of jumped off from there and added some of my own influences into it. For Ethel, that's our old lady driver, which was her original designation in the original documents. Old lady driver. Yeah, I definitely took some Estelle Getty and I mixed it in there with a real life serial killer named Dorothea Puente. She was a boarding house killer. She ran a boarding house. She killed people who she brought into that boarding house and stole their social security checks. That's how they caught her.
Wow.
But if you look her up, I think you'll also find some resemblances there.
So wait, we have a Betty, we have an Ethel. Scott, are these all named after Archie Comics characters?
No, her name isn't actually Betty. Her name was I just said, think of Betty from Archie.
Okay, all right.
Except she's a bodybuilder.
Yeah, explains that sweet ponytail, though.
I love it.
The giraffe, Moose, right there.
Yeah, you never know. But, you know, the thing is, like, nothing I saw in my head was all totally steamrolled by what Max actually drew and designed, you know. So it's not like I created them in the sort of large sense, right? And I gave a sentence about what I saw them as, but Max created them in terms of how they look and like entirely. But the thing is, you know, when I was putting the book together, and I talked to Max a lot about this too, is like, you know, if we were going for like a hyper realistic crime serial killer and it's full of serial killers, we would have a book of indistinguishable white guys, right? Every killer would just be an indistinguishable white guy. And I said that would be super fucking boring, you know, because there's gonna be so many of them. We need these visual cues so you can tell who everybody is, because they don't show up that much because there's so many of them, right? Like maybe a page an issue every other issue or something like that, depending on who it is. So we did take this very sort of super villainish approach to a lot of the way they look, to make them larger than life, to make them feel scary, to make them very visually, you know, memorable. So that was our approach, just really big, bombastic, you know, visually.
Yeah. I have a question about the setting. We talked a little bit about it, and one of the scariest things is the hopelessness of the fall. Falling apart infrastructure of Colonia, if I'm getting that correct. Why did you make it a fictional city set, I guess, in the maybe near future, it feels like, rather than a place, a real place?
It's more interesting, right, just to make it up. Then I don't have somebody going like, well, actually, Elm Street doesn't actually cross. You know what I mean? Like, who gives a fuck, right? Who cares? It's like, if we make it up, we have total control over it. That's like the simple answer. Like, make it up, total control, no worries. And then the near future setting actually plays in pretty heavily to the book as it progresses. So there's a lot of little things throughout the book. Like we never really specify exactly when it takes place to sort of not date things, you know, like 20 years from now, you're like, oh, you really fucking got that wrong, you know? So it's
we're
kind of
way better off than this kill city.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's sort of where it came from. It was just, if we create it, total control, no worries, we can do what we want.
That said, Max, did you use any visual reference for the city, and was it Baltimore?
I was definitely pulling on my experiences in various cities. Mm-hmm. I've traveled around a fair amount. I used to work in television production, which it sounds like, Justin, you might know something about.
He's a line producer.
Very dystopian.
That's the money man.
Yeah, he's all money.
The line producer is always the person you want to be on their good side. They're getting that check to you. But I worked in reality TV, and I traveled to a lot of really fabulous places and a lot of like junk places. I'm not going to name names after calling them junk places, but I've been in a lot of crumbling cities.
I have so many questions. What did you do in, if you totaled side trip, what did you do?
I was a camera operator.
Nice. Ooh. Oh, man. You've seen so much.
Which shows did you work on? What reality shows?
I did that for 10 years as a freelancer, so a lot of shows. Man. My very first job was in pre-production, driving a grip truck for, at that time, a secret game show, reality game show, called The Apprentice.
Wow. Yeah.
Season one.
Oh, boy.
So I'm aging myself here, dating myself.
Mm-hmm. How was the host of that show? Was he a nice guy?
Never talked to him. You know, he doesn't talk to us.
Just talk to the grip truck.
Did you ever work at Wife Swap? I can't imagine
he was down there.
Wife Swap? No.
What was that? Did you work at Wife Swap, Pete?
Because I did. That show broke me.
Oh, man. Because you had to swap the wives back and forth. Yeah. You were the wife swap.
He had to negotiate this swap.
Max, what, not to stay on this, but I'm curious, what led to the career change, or was it always in the background that you wanted to be a comic book artist?
Yeah, I always wanted to be a comic book artist ever since I was a little kid. I was drawing comic book characters, making up my own. I started making my own comics and photocopying them. I think when I started, it was at my dad's office, and I was probably using up all their toner. So then my mom would start taking me to, you know, Office Max or somewhere. And I would sell them at the local comic book shop. I always wanted to do that. And then I went to art school, where they taught me that that was wrong. And in so many words, it took me another 15 years or so to break the programming. And that's when I went back to school, to the Kubert School.
Oh, wow.
And,
awesome.
You know, started the whole process from there. That's, you know, that's why my career's gotten started a little later in life than I think maybe a lot of other people in the field.
But, it's never too late, man.
You know, I've got as much fire in my gut for it now as I feel like as when I was a 13-year-old kid, you know, learning how to use a T-square for the first time. Yeah. And here we are, yeah.
Well, all that life experience.
And what better way to inspire an insatiable bloodlust than working in reality TV for that one?
It's true. It's true. And, you know, also the value of shot selection and...
of course.
There you go. You know, that makes sense.
Storyboarding, all that.
I don't want to put you guys on the spot too much, but obviously a big question mark that's happened over the past couple of weeks in particular is about IDW originals and what's going on with them. Obviously, your book is coming out, and that's great. There's a couple of other books that have been canceled or pulled for various reasons. Do you have any insight there? Was that anything you were worried about? Was there touch and go with your book, or are you good to go at this point?
We're good to go.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Awesome. I think we were kind of ahead of the curve. I think a lot of the books that got canceled were part of another wave that was coming. Mm-hmm. And
we had a lot in the can. Yeah.
Yeah. We had already put a lot in the can. Like I said, we're already starting into issue 5 now. And I chalk it up to the larger contraction going on
everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do hope that a lot of those projects, you know, I've heard about a lot of them and there's some cool stuff. So I hope that they can find their way, you know, to another avenue to be seen.
Yeah. I mean, that's
day in the sun.
Seems to be happening. Obviously, you guys probably have more insight than I do, but it certainly seems like a lot of those projects have been given back to the creators so that they can take them to other publishers, that they can put them on Kickstarter or wherever. So I'm very glad to see that. Also very glad to see that you guys are going to get to do this book. Is this, at this point, is it planned as an ongoing, as a miniseries? Where is it at?
It's 8 issues, but 2 of the issues are double-sized. So it's essentially 10. It's the length of 10 issues, but it's in 8. So 5 and 8 are double-sized.
Okay. Oh, awesome.
Fun.
Why specifically those issues, or is that something you can't talk about yet?
It's boring, long story, but it is what it is, and we're psyched. It's actually cool because, like, I think there's a lot to every issue. There's a lot that's there's a lot happening in every issue. So I think like getting double length is actually kind of cool. And then I think when cover price wise, it comes out to a dollar cheaper than buying two issues anyway. So
it's all right.
Awesome.
Win-win, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
That's awesome. I mean, there's so much going on in this first issue already. It feels like a really good, not to use another medium, but it feels like a really good pilot to me, just in terms of you're very clearly setting up these characters, the situations. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of huge ideas, but you have these literal cops on the ground who are giving us a sense of everything, and it really starts to come together in a really nice way by the end of the issue. So,
and tone is so well set as well, like, which is something that I think is hard in any medium, especially comics, to really have a specific tone right out of the gate. So
it is meticulously plotted. You know, pretty much every page I had laid out what was going to happen so I could get the pacing right before I wrote the first issue. So it's very sort of tightly laid out, to be, super rewarding, like a great TV show or a novel or something like that. Right. Where it's all this big one piece, right. Being less, it is sequential in the sense that each issue tells a sort of its own story, but it's just a big monster. Yeah.
And we put a lot of care into the tone of this thing overall too. You know, our colorist has been just phenomenal. Valentina Risky. We worked together in the beginning just to make sure that we were making this city feel the way it needed to feel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, giving each character kind of some signatures as far as the color and the lighting and everything. I mean, Scott had been mulling over typefaces for the lettering for, I don't know, maybe a year or more before this was ever even, like, before we even had a
deal.
Well
done.
You know, we would talk about, you know, the typefaces he's looking at, like, oh, I like this one because it's kind of condensed, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So everything has, every element has been painstakingly vetted.
It shows. And I feel a little burnt because you late Face Smasher took my diner order, and that's fucked up.
Man, there's one thing I like writing about. It's food.
Food. Yeah.
I mean, my last book was all about fucking fast food, right? So, I like to fantasize about what my diner order would be. So part of that is just me getting fucking excited, you know.
It shows in this book particularly. I was like, this is such a fantasy diner order to sit down and say all of those foods at once.
Should I give him the scoop about my little Easter egg that I'm putting in?
Yeah,
Every issue, I've put in some reference to hot dogs.
Nice.
Okay.
You can.
There's a lot of Easter eggs throughout. Not only like little things like that, but also things like there are things in the first issue that you will have no way of understanding that they're even a thing until you get to the fifth issue, and then you go, "Holy fucking shit!" And you got to go back and read it because now you're thinking about it with a different a different perspective. So there's a lot of things like that, and then the hot dogs. There's so many little things. Like every panel's got all sorts of shit in it, you know.
Awesome. I'm going to have to go back and read it again right after the show to find out what was going on
about the
hot
dogs.
Yeah, you got to figure out the dogs.
Before we let you guys go, anything else you want to plug? Obviously, this is top of mind, but any other projects from either of you people should be checking out, or places online or anything like that? Scott?
Yeah, well, the True Cult trade paperback is just out earlier this month. Nice. Also from IDW Originals. That's the book I did with Liana Kangas last year. Satanic fast food crime book. Super happy with how that turned out. The cover is so fucking pink. You can see it from Mars. It's amazing. It's exactly what we wanted. And then the other thing is I have a book. It comes out the week after Kilmore number one comes out, called The Left Hand Path, and that's from a new publisher called Dead Sky. And that's a sci-fi horror book with the artist Ken Knudsen. And you think Kilmore is bleak, this book is bleaker than fuck, and I apologize. But it's just a one shot, so you just have to get through it. But it's pretty brutal. Yeah.
And Max, what about you?
Well, I'm all in on Kilmore for the time being, but my Kickstarter project from a couple years back, my wrestling romance comic, The Motherfucking Fucker, about a giant purple luchador and his lady love, Tigoria Killblood. I've been in the background working on a Motherfucking Fucker summer special, which obviously is not going to be making it out for this summer because, you know, Kilmore has kind of blossomed into this consuming thing. But I did decide recently that whenever I get it done, I can kind of repackage it as the Motherfucking Fucker Climate Change Forever Summer Special.
smart.
Truth.
Oh man! So
if we have to go that way, but be looking out for that at some point.
Catchy title, I love it.
Thank you.
Awesome, guys! Congratulations on the book. It is amazing, really, really great. I can't wait to go back and check out the hot dogs, read the rest of the issues, etc., etc. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks, guys.
Good to see you.
Later. See you.
All right, there we go. Once again, the book is called Kilmore. It's out from IDW on September 13th. Definitely check it out. It's awesome. And let's bring in our next guest into the stream. He is the creator of the new book, I Am Stan, which is coming out from Penguin Random House on September 12th. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Scioli. Hello, Tom.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey,
first of all, did I mangle your last name? Is it Scioli?
That sounded great. Yeah.
Yeah, I did it? Okay. Whew. Sweating that one a little bit. Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is, as mentioned, also coming out in September. This is a graphic novel biography of Stan Lee that is told mostly through his words and the words of others. It's kind of a reported piece in a certain way. You certainly pulled on a lot of different material. Where did the idea start with this? Where did the research start for this?
Yeah, I mean, the idea, like, doing a... I did a Jack Kirby graphic biography prior to this, so it's kind of like a Stan Lee one is just the natural next step. But and the publisher did ask about that as a possibility, and at the time I just wasn't... I was so, worn out, you know, doing that, the Jack Kirby thing was such a big task, and Stan is like a big part of that story. So like the idea of immediately going right back to work on a, you know, comics biography with a lot of the same, you know, the same cast, I just was not ready for it at the time. So I worked on a bunch of different other things and, you know, pitched a bunch of different things and stuff. But as like the years went on, the Stan Lee thing was just in the back of my head, and I thought of like some ways of doing it that would be interesting and would make sense. And so eventually I got to the point where like I was like, yeah, I think I really want to do a Stan Lee book, you know, and then it was on.
Well, why this approach then specifically in terms of it's really, he's in, I think, not every panel, but pretty much every panel, almost front and center right there. It's very focused on his POV. Obviously, the book's called I Am Stan, but I'm wondering why that.
Yeah, I mean, he is somebody who was not shy, you know, like really courted attention and, you know, wanted all eyes on him. And, you know, became, you know, as he sort of evolved his public persona, he became a very interesting person to watch, like almost like he almost cartooned himself, you know, and just was like a perfect fit for the comics medium. So I didn't feel like a distance. I didn't feel like, you know, like I felt like you could just kind of point the camera at him and see where he goes, and I took that approach with it.
What about the look of the book? It almost feels like this is like a book you'd find like in a stack of comics, it's this great, almost magical history of Stan Lee. Why'd you go in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, my approach and style had just sort of been, you know, evolving in that direction to begin with, this idea of something like from another era, and yeah, feeling like it's always been there. But the big change with this one was just like the layout strategy, the panels. You know, it's a lot of widescreen. It's a lot of letting like the action sort of just, you know, flow almost in real time. And then the drawing style was kind of, you know, closer to like mid 20th century, like comic strip as opposed to comic books or humor comics, which, you know, Stan Lee did his share of humor comics, like in that sort of, you know, long career he had before he became, you know, like the 1960s Stan Lee that we know. He had a very long career and worked in like every imaginable genre. And so it just, you know, the aesthetic just made sense. I saw him in like sort of a like a Mad Men kind of, you know, world, you know? And so that kind of like, you know, 50s or early 60s kind of look made a lot more sense as opposed to, you know, drawing it in a style that was, you know, closer to like an actual Marvel comic. Like that didn't feel appropriate for the story of Stan Lee.
One of the things you touched on this just a little bit before, but one of the things I'm always struck by whenever I read about his story and read something that encapsulates it like this is it almost feels to me like he didn't want to do comics. Like he did so many other things, and there were so many other things that he tried to do, and then he got sucked into comics for a ton of his life, and he kept trying to pivot it to other things, and ultimately that's the only place his life took him. Was that your impression writing this up as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard all the stories and that was part of his, you know, patter, and when he'd hold court it was sort of talking about how, you know, he envisioned himself as an actor or as a novelist, and Stan, you know, he chose the name Stan Lee because he didn't want to use his real name because he wanted to save that for his real career. Like I'd heard all those stories, but just like in the research and like really digging with it, I was kind of shocked like how true that was. Like I thought, oh, that's, you know, that's kind of a funny thing to say, that's a good soundbite. But yeah, it really was true. He really didn't come from a comics like fandom world, and he was there at the beginning of comics more or less, but he was like a little bit younger than Jack Kirby and Joe Simon, but he was still young enough that he probably could have enjoyed comics and Jack Kirby too. He was never like a comics fan, like there just wasn't such a thing, but he liked comic strips and things like that, and he loved the pulps. But I feel like, yeah, Jack Kirby and some of the other Marvel people kind of like, you know, became fans of the medium and really loved the medium and loved what they could do with it. But for Stan, yeah, he kind of, you know, like he got as much out of it as a person could, but he had sort of like a social climbing impulse that I think comics were incompatible with.
He's such a complicated figure. Over the course of researching something like this and working on it, does it change the way you perceive him? Do you like revere him less, or how does it change when you're?
Yeah, I mean, it is like if you make a book about somebody, you're gonna like they're gonna mean more to you. Like even if you came away, you know, not liking the person or something. Like I don't know. Like it would be hard for me to imagine doing something like this where I'm like in his shoes and seeing things from his point of view and come away from it like disgusted with him or something. Like I just had a ton of empathy for him, you know, for a lot of things, especially like the things that happened later in his life. But I feel like I just have like a clarity with him and I have a clearer view of things and he is, you know, for all his faults, he is extremely likable. Like he, you know, you do kind of like, even, you know, some of his harshest critics and things kind of, you know, in spite of yourself, you kind of get, you know, caught up in this, you know, in that world he creates.
Well, a couple things. First, we got to address, you're getting shout outs in the chat here. You do have incredible hair, so congratulations on that.
yes, thank my grandfather for that.
Well, nice. Lovely. Secondly, yeah, we got to interview him. He is a character, and this book is so bright and kind of really shows his love, your love for him. What are some of your just kind of like proudest moments or happiest moments about making this book that you were so happy you got to put this in here, like this part that you want to talk about or share for people?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it was the same thing with the Jack Kirby book. Like, that my favorite parts, like, for me, they're not necessarily the most profound parts or maybe the parts that would stand out for you know, like the reader or something, but it's like, you know, like, I'm a big fan of you know, glam rock and 70s stuff. And so, you know, he was interviewed by Mark Bolan from T-Rex once. It was, you know, like, I was like, okay, I got to put that in there. You know, I'm not going to not put that in. And like the stuff with Kiss. And so like little things like that. And then when Jack Kirby in his career and then Stan Lee in his career start kind of like working in Saturday morning animation and stuff, like that was during like my era. That was me when I was like, you know, three or something, was when those like, you know, 80s Marvel cartoons and stuff were coming out. So that touching on that kind of stuff was a lot of fun too.
Cool.
I want to ask you the opposite tone of Pete's question, and I'm going to ask it in a very reductive manner, but since you did a Jack Kirby biography and you've done a Stan Lee biography, are you team Jack Kirby or are you team Stan Lee? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like obvious, like, it's pretty obvious that I'm like team Jack Kirby. Like, that's where I came from. And when I did the Jack Kirby book, it's like, okay, I did it. I did my comics biography, never doing one of these again. Like I can cross it off my list and things like that. So like, you know, there was always going to be a Jack Kirby book for me, just cause like I'm so, you know, like I'm just so sort of attached to him for a number of reasons, but so yeah, I think, you know, obviously Stan Lee, but it's not to say I dislike Stan Lee or don't have immense, you know, affection for him. And I did meet him once. I never met Kirby. I did meet Stan Lee and I did get the opportunity to tell him, you know, what a fan I am of him. And
that's awesome.
And, you know, yeah, it was pretty cool.
Well, I feel like, real quick, Alex, yeah, I feel like please. It's such a split to choose between Lee and Kirby, but I feel like they are what comics became, sort of the like unbridled creation and that Carnival Barker nature of comics. So like they're sort of essential on both sides.
Yeah, they're part of the DNA like that. And yeah, that like it's like even like with Stan in particular, like since I come from sort of an art background, the Jack Kirby stuff is like it's a little more obvious, like the influence and the debt that I owe him. But with Stan Lee, it's like that Stan Lee voice, that kind of writing that he does, that really is the, you know, that's like the bass tone. Like that's if you're writing comics, that's kind of where you start. And maybe you like do a little more of this or a little less of that, or maybe you even, you know, deliberately try to do the opposite of some of it. But like the Stan Lee way of, you know, comic dialogue or whatever you want to call it is like, it's still the standard.
Yeah.
To keep plumbing into this a little bit, because having read the book, I thought it was very interesting how you presented their relationship, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee here. It felt very poignant about it. It felt very earnest about it. Obviously, they have their friction, but a lot of the time when you're drawing Jack Kirby, you know, he's chopping on his cigar. He's just kind of hanging out there. He's like, well, I'm a dude. I'm out of here. And even when they have that phone call on the radio show, it's still, the tone to me felt very considerate of each other, very loving in a certain way with each other. Obviously, we weren't there, but is that your take on it, or was that how you toned it because you're coming from Stan Lee's perspective?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Jack Kirby in like my Jack Kirby book was the internal Kirby. Like you're seeing Kirby from the inside out. You're seeing like where this one is the external Kirby. So you're seeing a lot more of like how Kirby comes across in the world, like, or how Stan might perceive him. So, you know, he looks older. He's a little more, you know, tough and gruff and world weary and filling the room with smoke and things like that. So it's just different because of the point of view. But I think, you know, all of their, the tensions that they had with each other, you know, there's like, you know, various, like the points where they're working really closely together and and where there's, you know, resentment of compensation and who's, you know, doing more work and things like that, and attention, you know, there's it's like any kind of like colleague or semi friend or professional friend or whatever. But as they got older, there were some, you know, resentments that festered and stayed in there. But as they got older, and I think, you know, anybody that lives, you know, beyond a certain age, like, you kind of find this, that like you just have so much more in common as you get older, because, you know, those you know, the people around you, like they found they had more in common than they did with each other than they did with maybe, like, you know, the assistant editors and the writers and you know, that who were, you know, from a completely different generation.
Can I ask you about a story that really struck me? I had never heard this before, or if I heard this, I completely forgot this. Did Stan Lee really whip people in the bullpen one time?
Yeah. I mean, there's like a phase, and it's interesting, like, what to make of it, but Stan Lee did have this brief phase, you know, sort of like post-war, where he had a tremendous amount of power and authority. And I guess, like, he was just like the right age. He was like still in his 20s, and he was, and he kind of became like, just, yeah, like a huge asshole for, and it seemed almost like he worked it out of his system or whatever, or maybe, you know, if you talk to some people, like those impulses just became less on the surface. But he did have this period, and it was sort of, like Harvey Kurtzman's wife was the, because she you know, worked in the office. I think she was Stan's secretary. I forget exactly what, but she was she had all these sort of stories about those days, you know, that version of Stan. And then there was a you know, there was you know, like a documentary and stuff, and there was an interview, I think it was with John Romita. And he, you know, he's talking about like, oh yeah, you know, Stan would whip us and things like that. And like, I'd seen that a bunch of years ago, but then when I was like watching all this stuff again and see, like, it was, you know, all these different accounts were sort of coming together, and it's like, yes, he literally had this like cat of nine tails, and he would come in and like, you know, work fast, you know, draw faster, you know, things like that, and start whipping them. And it's just like, it kind of blew my mind. It's one of those things that, you know, the first couple times you hear it, it doesn't even compute. It just goes right over your head, because you can't imagine. But yeah, just that reality of, like, you know, young, you know, enfant terrible or whatever, you know, yeah. Stan Lee kind of
three martinis
his power.
In.
Yeah.
Who among us in our 20s? I mean, come on, right?
Yeah. Has right.
Whipped people in our
bullpen. I'd whip some people.
Let's not do that.
In the afternoon, after a long morning? Come on. Whip.
Gotta keep them motivated, right?
But for Stan, it was like, you know, ha ha ha, it's just a joke, you know, but meanwhile, he's like whipping these guys, and they're like, hey, you know, we don't think it's funny. You know, you think it's funny. We don't.
Yeah. One of the things that I really liked that you did, I don't know if we're spoiling too much about this book that's coming out in a couple of weeks now, but one of the things I really liked you did was taking the stories he would tell and breaking it up over time to either show how they were consistent over time or inconsistent over time as he got older. Can you talk about structuring those sequences in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I've like, just sort of the research into memory and what is memory has like just changed so much just in recent years and come a long way. And where, you know, it used to be such kind of like a gotcha moment of like catching somebody in some factual error. But what we've kind of learned is that like everybody does that, and everybody, like, it's not, you know, in like most cases, it's not like a deliberate, you know, dishonesty, or it's just like, that's kind of how the human brain works. And like, none of us are aware of it. Like, we are not, like, we all do it to varying degrees. And it's like unthinkable, because that memory just kind of like seems so real. But there are like, you know, two different memories get merged and things like that. So, you know, and with Stan, you know, we just sort of have that record, and his stories were like, there's just a record of them, and you see them evolve, and you see, you know, the little changes that happen bit by bit until they get crystallized. And then once they're crystallized, it's just like, it's the Stan Lee show. And he just, mm-hmm. it's very rote and he just rattles them off. And it was like, going into this book, it was a little disappointing in some respects, because I kept hoping to find, because I thought like, yeah, okay, like let's hear Stan's side of the story. And then like so much of it was just, it's, you know, the substance, just what, like these were anecdotes and there'd be a laugh and there'd be a this, but like you wouldn't learn much from listening to, you know, to going to like one of these Stan Lee lectures, I guess.
Yeah.
You'd be entertained maybe.
Well, I'll say, I mean, this is not to talk about my personal experience, but when I was working at MTV, we went out to interview Stan Lee. And it was great because he was putting on the Stan Lee show just for me, sitting across his desk. And I was like, this is delightful. I'm having a delightful time. And we got some great footage there, and it was a great interview. But it was the moment that we turned off the cameras and like we were putting them away and starting to put stuff away that he just sort of like slumped down in his seat and became a human being and started talking. And it was such a difference, and it was so palpable in terms of like, oh, he's just being a person now. He's not putting on the Stan Lee that you see. So yeah, I guess he could turn it off sometimes. I did want to ask you to that point. I mean, this is, I think, every comic book fan, but I teared up reading the end of this book because the end of his life is such a tragedy in my mind. It's so heartbreaking to read. What was it like putting that section together in particular for you?
It was really hard. Like it was emotionally hard for me. Like it was like, and I didn't work in sort of strict chronological order when I was working on it, but there was it kind of like, I like those last, you know, the last parts of his life, a lot of it, I was sort of doing it after going on this journey with him. So it affected me, and it had sort of, you know, it stuck. Like it kind of lasted for a little while. For a little while there, I was just really, just like sad and bummed out about the whole thing. And you know, different things would happen, maybe like in the news or in comics, you know, like with, you know, maybe his generation or, you know, even like the guys who, you know, are like a generation or two younger than him are still getting up there. And so like little things would happen. Like it would just really, yeah, it would really just be irksome. It was rough. Like I was going through it and I could imagine because as a reading experience, it's like you're seeing this guy's entire life laid in front of you in this format. And so you really do see like this child, kind of, you know, grow up and you know, kind of, you know, you know, turn into, you know, just kind of age and then, you know, go, just disappear. You know, it's you know, it was, and so working on it was just this like meditation on mortality and you know, life and.
Yeah. Wow. That's cool. Man, well, it definitely got me at the end there. So good job on that in terms of channeling the emotion and everything. Before we let you go, anything else you want to plug in particular? Obviously, I Am Stan is the big thing that's coming out in a couple of weeks, but anything else people should check out?
Yeah, right at the same time, the same publisher, 10 Speed, is putting out a softcover edition of Jack Kirby, The Epic Life of the King of Comics.
Oh, nice.
You know, for anybody who missed it the first time around. And then also from Image Comics, I have this project that's coming out. It's like at the printer right now. It's called Jack Kirby's Star Warriors: The Adventures of Adam Starr and the Solar Legion. And ooh. It's a pretty interesting project. I kind of took this like lost Jack Kirby science fiction series that he did like way at the beginning of his career, like one of the first comic books that he worked on, and kind of, you know, remastered it kind of, cause it's a little like scattered and it's like here and there and over there. And I kind of, solidified, messed around with some of the layouts of it and things. Cause it was such an early work of his that like the drawing was amazing. The writing was amazing. The storytelling was amazing. But then the comic book aspect of it was a little off. Like, you know, some of those like really old comic books where they're like kind of stacked. And so I kind of just took them out of that context, gave them like a little room to breathe and cool. You know, did some little things with it here and there and made this like really nice presentation. I'm really excited about that one too.
Cool. Awesome. Awesome. Tom, congratulations on the book. I can't wait for everybody to see it. I'm definitely going to check out the Jack Kirby one as well. Great talking to you.
Thanks, Tom.
Still here? Am I still going? Hello?
You were gone for a minute there, I think.
Yeah.
And honestly, we didn't know what to do.
Oh, my God. Anyway, the book is called I Am Stan. It is out on September 12th in comic book stores and bookstores everywhere. So definitely check it out, whether you are a Stan Lee fan or fan of comics or just fan of things that we tell you to buy, I guess.
The ultimate fan.
The Last Kids on Earth and their superhero alter egos are back in the latest installment of the graphic novel spinoff series, The Last Comics on Earth, Too Many Villains. Jack, June, Quint, and Dirk face their biggest challenge yet, creating the sequel to their hit graphic novel in a mad dash, puzzle-filled race across Apocalyptia to stop the biggest evil plan in history. Hey, you know what the creators of Last Comics on Earth's evil plan is? Make me and my kids love these books. Seriously, my younger kid is a huge fan of both the Last Kid series and the Last Comic series.
It's true.
And now I'm hooked too. The whole team has created a delightful cast of characters with some fantastic kid-friendly art throughout that will appeal to readers of all ages. Buy your copy of The Last Comics on Earth in stores today. You can also visit lastkidsonearth.com to learn more. Yeah, there you go. All right, why don't we move on with our next section, which is my favorite section because you all make it up. It's your audience questions. Woo! And for audience questions, all you got to do is drop a question in the comments over on Facebook, YouTube, or Twitch, and we'll get to them. They can be about anything. They can be geek culture stuff, comic books, love life.
Yeah.
But the only question I have is, what are you guys drinking tonight? Pete, what you drinking? What you drinking?
Stealing a beer from my brother's fridge, you know.
The champagne of beers? Is that what you're having?
No, I'm having a Miller Lite.
Isn't that the champagne of beers?
Miller High Life, Alex. God,
Alex,
how
come
can
on,
you
man.
Embarrass yourself this
if you don't
much,
know, right? Don't say something, all right? Jesus.
That's what a podcast is. That's the concept
Jesus
of a podcast.
Christ,
if you don't
man.
Know something, you say something anyway.
No.
We guess it's stuff we claim knowledge of. That's the whole driving factor.
Yeah, and now politics. Let's talk.
Yeah. I'm drinking hotel room coffee,
which
is like it's not even a Keurig in this hotel room. It's another little device that makes very bad coffee, and boy am I enjoying it.
I'm drinking a Lagunitas IPA. That's pretty good.
No pumpkin.
The caramel pumpkin was not great. So
no, the caramel pumpkin was bad. Wow,
what a world.
This is the news.
I don't even want to live here anymore. I don't want to even be here anymore. Hashtag I think you should leave. Why don't we get to some questions? This is from Frederico Rosa. Alex gave his opinion last week, but what are you guys thinking about Ahsoka?
I watched the first episode.
First one?
There are two.
Yeah, there are two.
Three tonight.
I know. Oh. I only had time to watch one. I don't know what to tell you, man. I'm busy right now. But I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to checking out the second one.
What is your? You liked the first one then?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Justin, what about you?
I like it better than a lot of the other stuff. I haven't watched Rebels yet. So this makes me want to go back and watch Rebels to really get the backstory. It's made a little bit better than some of the other ones. So I think that's good. I think the writing's better. It still has this bleak sort of emotionless tone that all of the new Star Wars have taken on for some reason. And I'm like, is everyone forgetting that the Star Wars, like Leia had a temper, Harrison Ford was like smiled sometimes. And we just have lost that in Star Wars.
That's the thing that's driving me crazy about it right now, because I really want to get into it and I really want to like these characters.
Alex, you already gave your opinion last week. It says on the screen there, so you don't need to, go into it.
You're right.
You only get one opinion.
This is from Pablo. What's the best comic you don't want to read again?
Wow.
Ooh.
Wow. That's a tricky question. I mean, I mostly read them once, so I guess all of them.
What? You never reread?
No, I go back to some of the faves, but I haven't gone back. I don't know if you know this, Pete, but there are new comics every week, and we read all of those.
I do know that. I've been doing the show with you for over 15 years now.
I do think a lot of the stuff that we've purposefully revisited for podcasts are things that I read and thought, well, I'm good. Like Watchmen, frankly, was one that I don't think I wouldn't have. I read it. I encapsulated it in my body, in my knowledge base. But going back, we did a podcast called Watchmen Watch back when Watchmen was on HBO. We reread and revisited every issue of Watchmen. And that was a really enjoyable, good experience. I was very happy about that. So I know that's not exactly your question, but that's definitely one that I would not have revisited otherwise. I'm glad we did.
Yeah.
There you go. This is from Derek. Worst experience filming Donald Trump or getting whipped by Stanley?
Wow. Real race to the bottom here. I think the actual experience would probably be, I guess filming Donald Trump is worse on all fronts.
Yeah. The weirdest part, we didn't really talk about this, but the weirdest part about that sequence in the book is he's whipping people with his cat of nine tails, and everybody's like, "What are you doing, Stan? Stop it." He's like, "I'm just joking. What are you talking about? It's just a joke. I'm just whipping you." Which is like, that's not a joke. That hurts. Like, there is no world where getting whipped with a cat of nine tails doesn't hurt horribly.
Well, I bet he was I think a cat of nine tails is sort of harder to, because it's so short. You'd really have to get up in there to whip somebody with it. I bet he was just threatening with them.
Yeah, if I ever
actively whipping them, that's even crazy.
I think that's what he was doing. If I ever got access to a time machine, 100%, the first thing I do is go back there, be like, was he actively whipping people or like jokingly whipping them? And that's then I'd the go back to my regular time and have like, I don't know, lunch or whatever. What? Wait, what?
Talk to Tom.
Talk to Tom. Okay, I'll talk to Tom. This is just a quick comment from Nat. You can't call it champagne of beers unless it's from the High Life region of America.
That's a great call, man.
That's good. Save that for your tight five, man.
Put that on the side of the case, guy. That's good stuff. The High Life region of America is, of course, everywhere in America.
This is from All in the Game. Sorry if you've already touched on it, but any thoughts for the 4-minute official teaser trailer of Rebel Moon? This is the new 2-part movie from Zack Snyder, coming to Netflix in December and April, I want to say. Have you guys checked out the trailer for this yet?
I have not, but the commentary was, is it possible that Zack Snyder made a good movie? Alex, wasn't that your take?
I don't think that was my take. I don't think I said anything about it. So first of all, the context for this thing is Zack Snyder had a Star Wars pitch that either got turned down or just didn't work out, and he had written a bunch of it, so he was like, great, I'll just make my own movie that's Star Wars, but I'll change some of the names and stuff. So if you watch the trailer, it's clearly people with lightsabers. There's clearly stormtroopers there. There's like a very Sith Darth Vader style character as well. So it's all that Star Wars stuff, but he's doing it. I thought it looked fine. It looked like a Zack Snyder movie. My big takeaway is I saw a lot of people, Zack Snyder fans in particular, posting these comparisons of like, what Zack Snyder could do with his iPhone, what Marvel does with $100 million, and footage from Rebel Moon compared to like Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. And every time, I didn't do this, but I wanted to respond and be like, you know, they both look like shit.
Wait, so, he filmed this on an iPhone?
I don't know. I don't know what they're talking about. Maybe, but it does not look good.
The idea of Zack Snyder being like, I'm going to rip off Star Wars and shoot it on my iPhone is like, okay, enjoy your weekend. Bye.
I like the trailer. I thought it seemed fun.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you liked it. Listen,
there you go.
He's a good visual filmmaker. I don't think he's good at story necessarily, but his stuff looks great when he's really crushing it. So I don't know. I'm always good. I'm always
up. And it sounds like he didn't need a new story if he just did Star Wars.
There you go. So he's good to go. This is from Michael Tilbin. We got lots of Easter eggs of the eventual demise of almost every Riverdale character in the last episode. But what the heck happened to Dr. Colonel Jr.? That's a great question. I can't believe we haven't talked about this yet.
Yeah, that is.
He lives forever alongside Nana Rose. They're immortal and resurrect. They continually resurrect and they just check out corpses.
In my last season rewrites, I have him as like a warlock slash wizard that teams up with Sabrina and, of course, Cheryl. So, yeah, he lives out his best life.
And let me just say, for those of you that maybe don't listen to our Riverdale After Dark podcast, what Pete just said sounded like casually said nonsense. But it's something that he, A, wrote down, and B, said in great detail on that other podcast. Don't worry. He means what he said.
Yeah. Great question, Michael. This is from Max Fuchs. Max, actually, just as a little note, is the artist of Killmore, which is coming out from IDW on September 13th. It's a great book, and you should check it out.
It's a nightmare of a book that's unbelievable, but it'll haunt you forever.
He says, I want to know everyone's favorite kind of candy. Pete.
I'm going to give Pete 40 minutes to answer this
question. All the flavors, all the kinds.
All the flavors? All
right. Yeah.
When you're saying flavors, it's like Snickers a flavor? Or is it
yes.
a...
Okay. Yeah, yeah. All, I'm just trying to say everything.
He has a 1950s soda fountain way of ordering candy. He walks into a place and goes, one candy, please.
Yeah.
And they hand him a little.
Whatever they hand me is great. It really depends on what's going on. If I'm really starving, I go with like a Snickers or something. A Milky Way is usually the top of my list.
More
but
of a meal
Butterfinger
candy.
Is also really great. Almond Joy is unbelievable. I also like a Twizzlers. You know what I mean? I'm not a Red Vines guy. I'm a team Twizzlers.
Yeah,
I
don't want
to. For dinner, when you have candy for dinner, Pete, what's your dessert?
That's when you go with the Choco Taco. Rest in peace. I wish you were still around.
Oh my God, you dig it out of its grave. I just want to mention, not to keep plugging other podcasts that we do on this podcast, but we do a podcast called Candy Bed, a Sweet Tooth podcast, where we taste candy every episode. And Pete, you've said many times. Eating candy is a way of making yourself full, and I just I still cannot wrap my mind around that. It just
when you eat
work.
Enough candy,
I mean, I guess, but that's not how you use that stuff.
Ice cream Snickers.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Come on.
Ice oh wait, we didn't answer, Justin. What's your Snickers. Favorite? Ice cream Snickers is your favorite.
Yeah.
Okay. Mine's Twizzlers, actually, which I know you guys have made fun of me for.
Yes, that's like saying Necco wafers.
Yeah, that's like saying I like to chew on electric cords, I guess.
Yeah.
Frederico Rosa again says, but about comics, what do you guys think was the best decade for comics and what was the worst?
Wow. Ooh.
That's wildly subjective.
Yeah.
It also, it's when you grow up. So I would say, I found that I have a soft spot for the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. Comics that I read and then went back and read when I was first getting into comics, because there was a wild time in comics. There were so many, everyone was putting crazy ideas on the page. There was such a vibe to it. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I'd say Justin's answer, but it's also the worst because of the insane kind of styles and stuff that happened. There was horrible comics that were made in the 80s, but I love them. And so, yeah, I mean, I was an 80s, 90s kid. So, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was, the thing that rocked my world and changed my love of comics forever. But also there was stuff that also came out in that area that I look back at and I'm like, oh my God. That's the great thing about comics is, if you keep reading, you're just going to find more and more amazing things. So,
candy.
I would throw out, I agree with you guys on I think the 2000s were really good just in terms of innovation for the mainstream publishers in particular. But I sort of feel like right now is one of the best times for comics. I know
that's a popular answer in the comments.
Well, legitimately, there are so many different types of comics you can read. It's not, if you never want to read Marvel and DC, you don't have to if you don't want to, because there are so many other amazing things going on. You have so many great creators and artists and people who understand how to create something because they've learned the lessons of previous generations. Frankly, like, if the image revolution hadn't happened, we wouldn't be getting what we get now because they learned the positive and negative lessons from that.
That happened in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously I have a soft spot for that stuff like you guys do, but comics are really good right now. And in terms of worst decade, just to slag off a decade, I would say the 70s, just because that was the time when things were just lost. Like, you were past the innovation of the 60s, and then you got into a place where everybody was doing whatever garbage they could put out there before you really started to get that innovation again in like the early 80s. With things like Frank Miller's stuff and Alan Moore's stuff and the British Revolution and whatever. So that feels like a little bit of a lost decade to me, kind of.
Yeah, even though I feel like a lot of comic book creators were straight up tripping balls when they were making comics.
Yeah.
So that was a whole vibe as well.
Mm-hmm. This is from Stray Bullet. What are your top five popular villains that you'd like to see unleashed on a city?
I would love to fight all the cards, the villains who are in every book where they get beat up.
Something gang.
The deck of cards gang.
The deck of cards gang. Yeah. God. Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
It'd be funny because we could just fight them on the streets.
Mm-hmm. The Royal Flush Gang.
Shouts to Michael Tillman. There'd be a fun to just casually beat up on your way to work. But I got to give it up for Pace Pop Pete LePage. I wish that guy would threaten New York City like he used to.
What about you, Pete? Popular villain you'd like to see unleashed on a city?
Well, you got to go with Magneto because the city's a lot of metal and he can just, you know, crush your town. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And destroy.
Wait, you want to see him crush your town?
Well, I think.
You're on the villain side?
That's what
Baltimore. Have you heard about that? That place is hell on earth.
Stop saying that, you asshole. I just think it's one of those things where, you know, when you want to see a villain unleashed on something, you want to see what kind of damage can happen. Then hopefully you can, you know, wake up the next day and be like, oh, it was all a horrible dream.
Yeah. I'd like to see Big Wheel. I think Big Wheel, that would be fun. Just like you're walking down the street and you see a Big Wheel come by.
Big Wheels were fun. Those were good times.
Kevin says, other than New York, what is the best and worst depictions of a real city in comics? Other than Matthew Rosenberg's Joker book, I'm going to say Los Angeles. It's just like, nobody knows what's going on there. Like, for the amount of people that live there, I'm like, what are you doing? This is not...
I don't think
West Coast Avengers handled the California
Los Angeles? Lifestyle. They were like, well, here we California are fighting Coast. On the Hollywood Walk of Fame again.
I love when they put Texas in a book. You know, we were talking about Texas Blue Beetle and some of the old Blue Beetle 2000s with Jimmy Reyes, with just some beautiful stuff. Sometimes they do a great job with Texas and just kind of the big sky stuff and the different colors you get. It's a little different than a city backdrop. So I always enjoy that.
I think Canada is always pitch perfect in comics. No notes.
No notes.
They always really nail.
Yeah, Alpha Flight knocks it out of the park every time.
Every time, yeah.
You can tell they really did some fact-finding missions up in Canada whenever they would take out an Alpha Flight book.
Yeah. Cool. All right, there we go. That is it for your audience questions. Boop, 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 boop. Yeah. We are going to move on with our next section, which is trivia. And for that, we're going to turn it over to Pete LePage.
All right.
Hot Pete LePage.
This is the part we give back to you, the lovely audience. It's an opportunity to win $25 free to Midtown Comics Online or, of course, Long John Silver's for some reason. We're looking for someone to just kind of put a hand up or, you know.
David Quinley will do it.
Oh, yeah. We got there the Quinn cycle. Right.
The Quinn jet.
Yeah. Quinley is up. So just answer in the comments and we will get you set up here. I'm probably going to feed you them in the comments. But Pete, are you ready?
Yes, I am. All right, today's trivia is on topical comic news and a small nod to the legend, Bob Barker, R.I.P. Please listen to all three options before making your selection. Here we go. Question number one. Kelly Thompson is writing, what Marvel comic coming soon? Is it A, it's Dupe, B, it's Jeff, the Jeff Universe number one, or C, Joe Sakic? So when in doubt, always go with maybe the longer one, which is B, it's Jeff, you know, just as a little bit of a hint. Or...
just to check if that was the answer, is this a new It's Jeff book? It's Jeff, Jeff Universe? Is that the idea?
Yeah, yeah, number one. It's a new It's Jeff book.
My son's going to be so excited. He's been asking about a new It's Jeff book for a while.
People love Jeff. I don't know what
David
your deal
says.
Is.
Hey, he got it wrong, so I guess he lost trivia.
I guess he did lose
we'll get you
trivia.
Next time,
yeah, maybe. That's the first time in 16 years of the show that somebody's lost trivia. But
yeah, but of course it's B.
Wait, no, can't you get two right?
Oh yeah, he could do like
three?
Two.
Yeah, but really run the board.
Nat is asking, who is Jeff? Jeff is a land shark who Hawkeye and Gwenpool hang out
with.
Who
is Jeff? Come on, Nat. Turn in your nerd card. Who is Jeff? Unbelievable. All right, here we go.
Nat lost worse than David, so David's back in.
Yeah, all right. What DC book, question number two, what DC book will Tom Taylor be writing? Is it A, Titans Beast World number one? B, is that his last name or just his initial? C, David K.
Oof, really leaning towards B here. That's
well, after he got the first one wrong, I wanted to make it super clear, and only one of them is the title of a comic book, and that is A. So I want to make it easy for our people who nicely volunteer.
That's really nice. It's hard to hear all the words you say, though, so you never know what people are going to listen.
That's true. Also, I stumble over words. I don't speak well. There's a lot going against people who volunteer.
You know? A? Is it A?
Yes, it is A.
Wow.
All right. Here we go.
Nice. Okay. One and one.
One and one. Last one. Here we go. What is the new project coming out for Ram V? Is it called A, Waiting for Beer, B, Waiting to Die, or is it C, fill up beer? So we might want to go with B on this one, just so you know there, David. Yes, Beast World is correct.
Nice.
What?
Nope, that was the last one.
That was the last question, but still correct. So
it's great to be right.
Yeah, if you answer the same question multiple times, you get multiple points for it. So congratulations, David. You have won the quiz. Just hit us up on email and we will get you a gift card to literally wherever you want. I got Kevin a gift card to Barnes & Noble the other day, so there's no rules anymore.
Oh, that's a nice treat.
Yeah, B is correct for the last
and
one.
And there's no way this movie's not Happy Gilmore, right?
It's definitely Happy Gilmore. We're talking about, of course, the 1996 cult comedy classic. Happy Gilmore.
Would you call it a cult comedy classic or a blockbuster comedy? It came out in the 90s.
Yeah, but people, you know, has that cult following. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess if our entire American culture is a cult, then that's technically a cult classic.
Thank you. Thank you.
Speaking
for
of cults, as we all know, new comic books are coming out all the time. What are you guys looking forward to that's coming out this week? Pete?
Oh, man, I got a straight Marvel pick where it's Ms. Marvel, the New Mutant number one, the Incredible Hulk number three, and Blade number two are all my favorites.
Justin, what about you?
Picking a comic that is tied to the Fall of X event, what a coup. The Marvel folks will be celebrating in the streets tonight, no doubt. I got to give it up for Local Man Gold, which is a book from Image I've been really enjoying by our main man, touchy-feely Tim Seeley, about a 90s-style Image hero who comes back to his hometown after his life gets all messed up. And I also want to shout out Cosmic Detective, which comes out not this week, but in a couple weeks, by Jeff Lemire and Matt Kent. That book looks like it's going to be excellent.
Yeah, but who knows? I guess I will give a shout out to a bunch of stuff that's coming out this week. I was really looking forward to Gnort's illustrated swimsuit issue, which is Worth it for the art alone.
Oh, worth it for the pun alone.
Worth it for the pun alone. They had me at the pun. I was like, I'm in. You son of a bitch, I'm in. All a second, Miss Marvel, the debut. That feels like the big title of the week. Very curious to see what they do with that. Also, very into the idea of Action Comics Presents Doomsday Special, where Doomsday is the king of hell. That's a wild thing from Dan Waters, who's been on a
great run.
That's
what I call
run.
A swerve. That's a swerve.
Sick covers. Man. Sick covers.
And very interested to see what they're going to be doing with Ultimate Invasion, as that is leading into a new Ultimate Universe. Should be interesting to check out. Mm. And folks, that is it for this week's show. A couple of people to thank. We want to thank Tom Scioli for coming on. Check out I Am Stan, coming out of bookstores and comic book stores on September 12th. Also, Scott Brian Wilson and Max Fuchs for coming out. Check out IDW's Killmore on September 13th. Next week on the show, Mel Valentine Vargas is going to be here for Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass.
No.
Oh, no, and me?
You. And Simon Hanselman and Josh Pettinger are going to be here to talk about Werewolf Jones and Sons. Bunch of other podcasts for us to plug. Scott Pilgrim versus the podcast. We just launched this. A Scott Pilgrim podcast. We're going to be counting down to the Netflix series. Comic Book Club News, our daily Comic Book Club News podcast coming out Monday through Friday. Sons of a Gun, our DC podcast coming out weekly with also some DC news right now. Marvel Vision, our Marvel podcast. That'll be probably coming back with some news as well. Riverdale After Dark, our Riverdale podcast should be done, but it's not. We have a new episode coming out tomorrow. Talking down your theories and questions. Patreon.com/comicbookclub. Support this show and all the shows we do. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice. At Comic Book Live on Twitter/X. Comic Book Club Live on Instagram or TikTok. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, good night.
Good night, everybody.
Take care of yourself. Comic-